Oh, many. we have toured so much. I mean, I'll tell you a time for anyone who's, I guess you can liken it to a string quartet, to chamber ensembles in whatever genre you're in. If you have something that you have grafted at and put lots of hours and lots of time in and made lots of sacrifices for, there are lots of times I could have possibly done, let's say, some orchestral work, but I'd have a tour in with the band and I'd stuck with that. Last summer we played at a festival in England called Croperty. I think we played to about 17,000 people. Now I've played to 20,000 people with other artists. That's not a daunting thing to do in any way, but when it's your own band and you're stood on stage and you're playing the songs that you've been playing for 10 years, playing in tiny little folk clubs, I cannot tell you how full my little heart was. Actually standing on that stage and going, this is our music and this is our product and our project. It's worth every bit of sacrifice and every bit of graft, I think.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. Eliza Marshall is a British flute player acclaimed for her expressive, multi-style playing. And in this episode, we're celebrating her new album, Eternal Birth, in which this award-winning flautist and composer channels over two decades of international collaboration into a bold, genre-defying album with a rich cinematic soundscape blending classical, folk, and world traditions, with haunting flutes, whistles, bansuris, spoken word, percussion, and electronics. Recorded in both the UK and Senegal, the album features an extraordinary lineup of world-class and Grammy Award-winning musicians: Addie Tune, Ansumana Suso, Drew Morgan, Donald Rogers, and Lena Jonsson. Eliza shared her rich musical life, her studies with Michael Cox, her varied career, including performing on the long-running West End show The Lion King in London, touring with Peter Gabriel, and the joys and challenges of using a loop pedal. She shared insights about the importance of the folk band Ranagrai in her life, her multidisciplinary project Freedom to Roam, her love of the Hebrides Islands, the importance of rewilding, and finding the courage to push boundaries and take risks. This episode is being released a few days before the release of Eternal Birth. You'll find the pre-order link on Eliza's website. I was really inspired to exchange ideas with her about living a life rich with connection and creativity. You can watch this video on my YouTube or listen to the podcast, and I've also linked the transcript. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the show notes of this episode on my website, leahroseman.com, where you'll find all the links, including different ways to support this podcast and other episodes you'll enjoy. Hey, Eliza, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. This is really wonderful of you.
I've really appreciated being able to listen to a preview of your upcoming album, which is coming out in a few days as we release this podcast.
Yes, very, very excited.
So Eternal Birth, it's really powerful, really beautiful. And, I listened to it several times. And what I'm hoping we can do is give people a taste of all the tracks. But in between that, we're going to talk about your life and music and all kinds of other things, if that works for you.
That's totally amazing. Thank you. Yeah, that's great.
You know, as we record this, I'm about to put out my episode with your friend, Lena Jonsson, the Swedish fiddle player who appears on this album.
She does, yeah.
Yeah.
She's absolutely extraordinary. How lovely. That's great.
How did you meet her, actually?
So I met her during COVID. We did something called Global Music Match online. It was run by lots of folk expos around the world. And we were both selected and we were put on the same group. So we just totally hit it off. I fell in love with her music and everything that she does. And we've kept in touch since then. I've been over to Sweden. We've done some gigs together. There might be some more stuff in 2026. Watch this space. It was actually incredible that during that time we were able to kind of meet lots of people, even though we couldn't get out. So,
yeah,
very, very happy about that.
So the first track, They Listen, I mean, you definitely talk about mortality and connection to ancestors on this project. Do you want to speak about that and people can listen to a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's really interesting. So the poem, the Thomas Hardy poem that inspired a lot or came to me during the writing of this album, it's called Transformations. And it's actually I've learned a lot from Thomas Hardy. It was his kind of moment of looking into reincarnation, I guess, and looking at that side of the life and death, I guess. That isn't necessarily how it is for me with the writing of this album, because it could be very much a scientific, you know, look at what happens to us and what our cycle is, if you like. But actually for me, there is, especially within this track, there's something really beautiful about thinking about our ancestry, whether that's spiritually or scientifically. I really love the idea that what's passed on from us and what do we pass on, and who's around us, what's there, what's out in the ether. I suppose that's really in the lyrics of this track, and I love those ideas. I love exploring that. So it was quite special to me, actually.
I was curious, Eliza, when you perform some of this live, because there's all this layering and you're doing spoken word and you're playing flute, how does that work?
So it's really interesting. That's such a great question. It's funny, isn't it, how we record things and then how we come to explore that as a live performance. And especially as when I do it live, it's often just me. And in the actual album, I've got lots of amazing percussionists, and particularly featured, I suppose, we've got Lena and we've got a Senegalese percussionist called Adi Tion. When it's just me, I have my loop pedal, I have my balafon. My life is that I'm a flute player, but I also have I've come to understand that I think what I like to do is open up textures. So that might be that I'm not, you know, trained or highly efficient balafon player, I'm not a highly incredible percussionist, but actually I can build textures, and with a loop pedal and with various electronic layers, that sort of sets a bedding, if you like, for what I then put over the top, whether that's a flute solo or whether that's my spoken word. And then if somebody comes to join me, like Adi has been on tour with me, then obviously that changes it and shifts it again, that we have the highly percussive element catered for, I suppose. But it's really interesting and quite exciting as a musician to say, okay, this is how I've recorded it, and now how am I presenting that live? And actually, it's very different, but it still speaks within the, I guess it honors the song still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, since you mentioned Adi, so I was curious, like, his father Yeli Tune has this dance company, like,
yes,
there's this interesting family connection.
Yeah, totally. Very sadly, he's just lost his father, actually. He's just passed on, but his dad and both his parents were amazing within the Senegalese kind of music scene, I suppose. They both worked for the Senegalese Ballet, the National Ballet of Senegal. In fact, his dad, I believe, he ran it. And for his generation, this was really incredible, actually. It meant that they went all over the world performing and dancing and being part of, that they're part of the Griot family, which means they're part of kind of a long line of musicians in Senegal. So I think I found that really inspiring to hear from Adi, that that's what he was brought up with parentally and within his family tree, I guess. It's a wonderful thing that they had this company.
I've been following you for a couple of years, and I've going to Senegal again. And I was curious, like, I know you went to Africa when you were quite young to do some volunteer work. I don't know which countries those were, but do you want to speak about those early experiences?
Yeah, I mean, I can take you right back to when I was growing up at school. I went to a very international school. It's called Steiner Education. And that meant that we had a lot of bands visiting us from all over the world. Whilst I was growing up, I was learning as a classical, I was being trained as a classical flute player, but I had these bands from South America, Rumeliata, Bolivian band. We had children coming over from Africa. We had a dance company, Kakuma. So those influences infiltrated my life. When I was 16, I did a huge project for my A-levels that was studying African rhythms versus minimalist Western composers. How did these sync up? Who was influenced by who? And was there any correlation in how people would write out rhythms or not write out rhythms, as it is in a lot of sort of oral traditions in Africa? So that inspired me. I then went on, when I studied at the Royal Academy of Music, I also looked at a lot of African music. And that then, of course, once I graduated, it was a no-brainer. I had to go out there, and I went to Cameroon, where I worked on a big music and drama production in the local area, the local village that I was in, Boya. It's actually a university town on the side of Mount Cameroon, which is a 12,000-foot mountain. So it's really exciting place to be, and really wonderful, wonderful people I was working with. So that sort of, I already had a love of the music of Africa, but that solidified the idea that this was somewhere I think I wanted to be quite often.
Let's talk about track two, Roots Entwined.
Okay, Roots Entwined. So, well, this was released as a single at the beginning of January. And I really wanted to release this at the beginning of the year. I feel like it's a really uplifting track. I want it to be all about how connected we are. You know, you hear a lot these days about our connection with nature, our connection in life. Look at the kind of global connections that we have throughout the world, I guess. And I wanted to really embrace that and really honour that, I suppose, as well. And the idea of roots entwined, I'm connecting this idea of humanity versus nature, specifically trees, I suppose, to a certain extent, and the idea that trees really nurture one another. You know, lots of things go on under the surface that we don't necessarily see, we don't witness, and I like the idea that we don't have to see it. Everything is so visible these days on social media, on it within our media, that actually there are these great things going on that we don't always hear about, and maybe we should hear about those. And maybe if we think about what's going on under the earth, of all those amazing roots that look out for one another and nurture one another, I like to liken that to humanity in a way.
I think we both read that book about the mother trees.
Absolutely.
Sending out
the... Yeah, that is the one. Exactly that. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yes. I've carried that with me since I first heard about that research.
Yeah.
I can't remember her name, though, the
scientist. No, I can't, but... actually, either. I never can, but it was a beautiful book.
Well, can you talk a little bit about your flute collection and what you played on this album?
Yeah, sure. I'm a flute player. I play the classical Western flute, silver flutes, Bohème style. Again, when I was younger, I discovered lots of whistles that I love, very Celtic influenced, I suppose, ranging from beautiful sort of wooden Scottish made Ormiston whistles to really amazing aluminium. I'm going to be really fluty geeky here, but then also recently I got another whistle. It's carbon fiber, randomly. Would never thought that would be something I'd have. It's absolutely beautiful. It's got a lovely tone. But then I go much further afield, so I have loads of bansuris, which are the bamboo Indian flutes. I have zhaos, which are Chinese bamboo instruments kind of modelled on the Japanese shakuhachi. They have a very haunting tone, I would say, so I love adding, you know, that extra colour. And then one of the things I suppose people often see when I'm performing live, particularly in my band, I have just a bass flute. It's very, you know, normal, but so many people haven't seen it, and I play it with in quite a rhythmic way. I love a lot of rhythm on the flute, as well as the fact that flute is always a melodic instrument. So So I have the bass flute, sometimes I have the alto flute, and I've recently done something at the Royal Opera House actually in London where I play a lot of ocarinas, so I sometimes bring that into. They're not actually on my album, but I do have those as well.
Those are those little round things with eight holes or something.
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly.
Okay.
They're amazing instruments. Who would have known? They're absolutely beautiful. They, again, every instrument, it's like it has its own little personality. It's very lovely.
I was curious about your bansuri playing, and I did interview Milin Date, and I'm going to link his episode to this one in the show notes, because like back in 2014, you were featured in Joby Talbot's ballet, The Winter's Tale, and you were on stage playing the bansuri. And I was curious, also, you had worked with the Sarod master, Amjad Ali Khan. So did you
Yes.
get like training in that in South Asian music?
I actually
Was it?
didn't, I have to say. So I've never had any training in any of the kind of alternative-y sort of instruments aside from my flute. And in a way, as I get older, I almost harness that as a, not a USP, but I believe in the fact that we're able to immerse ourselves in different music and in different people's playing and learn from that as much as when as going and learning with a guru or, you know. So my Indian style of playing absolutely isn't, I would never say I can play in the style of any of these wonderful Indian gurus. But I can bring the flavors that I think the instrument serves the instrument still.
Eliza, you said USP, USB. What did you mean? Did you mean?
Well, I suppose like a unique selling point, as in, I mean, it's my
Oh, okay.
individual. That's a terrible term to use, isn't it? But it's almost like I embrace the fact that that's very unique to my style of playing. So the Joby part, for example, I went round to Joby's house when he was writing that ballet, and we kind of went through various different instruments and talked through what might represent what he was trying to represent within the play and within the atmosphere he wanted, and that was the instrument we thought would work well, and then we thought how he could write for it. So we worked it out in our own way to a certain extent. Of course, he wrote it all, but that was a really enjoyable process to see which instruments would work for the soundscape he was trying to create.
Well, actually, let's talk about track three, Our Times Reborn.
Yes, Our Times Reborn. Okay, so it's called Reborn because it was released earlier this in 2025 as a digital release on the Real World Digital label. And that was just Our Times. And it had some beautiful kora on it from a lovely kora player called Ansumana Susu. But I actually had some lyrics that I wanted to use on it. So we decided to remix it. The remix doesn't actually have the kora part, but it has the spoken word. So that's why it's reborn. It's a rebirth of that particular track. And oh, I love this idea. Look, even now, look what you're doing with your amazing podcasts. I love this moment in time. What is our time that we spend here together? Who is it that we spend our lives with? Who crosses our paths? Who are our politicians? Who are our partners? You know, what comes in and out of our lives? And I think I'm such a harnesser of the moment that we're part of that I really wanted to express that, I guess, in words and make us look again. Maybe there's a theme accidentally of sort of being slightly anti-negative media in that. I want to harness things. I want to find opportunities and things and look for the what we can make of this time. This is our moment here. So what do we do with it?
Yes, and although you've had a long and interesting career, which we'll get more into, this is your first solo album, your own compositions.
It really is, and it's really strange to do that when you've spent, you know, 25 years essentially. I write within my band, Rana Grai. We write lots of tracks together, but that's co-writing, and I obviously perform for lots of other composers and perform their music. So to actually suddenly come around and have your own voice in something, or write your own words, or, you know, again, Our Times, it really features the balafon. And that's just, I'm just creating textures. I love Steve Reich. I love six marimbas. I absolutely love minimalism. So to be able to go, okay, I'm going to try doing this. I'm going to see how that might work. And then maybe the flute here. And then what do I want to express lyrically, even though I'm not a singer? It's very, very liberating. And it's also really nerve-wracking.
I wanted to ask you about Steve Reich. I was curious, first of all, do you know Sarah Jeffrey of Team Recorder?
No, but I sounds like I should do.
Yeah, so she's been based in Amsterdam for many years, but she's British.
Right.
And she does also teach in London. So she has made it her mission to get the recorder loved. And she plays across many centuries, but she plays a lot of mostly contemporary music and also experimental improvisation, and very interesting person. So she's been on this podcast.
Oh, cool.
And we featured a clip of her, Steve Reich's Vermont Counterpoint, which she did for Recorder.
Oh, brilliant. Ah, amazing. I bet that was incredible. I will
yes,
look her up.
Yeah. Yeah, she's something else. You guys should be friends.
Oh, amazing. That's brilliant. I will look her up.
No, I wanted to ask about some of your mentors when you were younger. So you studied with Michael Cox at the Birmingham Conservatoire?
Actually, I studied with Michael. I was at the Birmingham Conservatoire when I was between 13 to 18.
Okay.
And then I was with Michael. I went to the Royal Academy in London, mm-hmm. and he was my teacher there. Michael is the most phenomenal flute player. I would say he's the flute player of our times. Excuse relating that to my title of my track. But he's absolutely phenomenal. At the time, he was principal of the London Symphony Orchestra. He then went on to be principal with BBC Symphony Orchestra for years. And he, what was wonderful for me was that I was in this highly classical institution. I had an amazing time there. I absolutely loved the Royal Academy. But Michael, I think, could see in me this slightly left field or slightly unusual approach to things. So I would turn up to a lesson and I'd have a little book of Chinese folk melodies, and maybe I should have been learning a Mozart concerto, but he really harnessed that, I think, and he embraced that maybe I had some slightly different ideas. So I, of course, did all the very classical stuff that I needed to do, and that's been a brilliant, you know, it served me fantastically in a particular area of my career, but also have it being open-minded to different sounds and different, even things like different vibratos that you use, you know, in different styles of playing. I felt like I couldn't have had a better teacher to be able to allow that to come to fruition within my playing.
Are these different vibratos generated differently physically?
I suppose they are once you go to a different instrument. So, for example, if you're playing a whistle, you might do like a finger vibrato, which is similar to, let's say, the Ilum pipes that are bellow pipes. So you can't use your airstream for the vibrato. And I think the whistle copies that to a certain extent, even though actually you are blowing down the instrument, so you could use your air. Mm-hmm. So yes, there are very physical things that are slightly different in that manner. And then there are just styles, I suppose. So I guess in sort of folk music, you would often maybe get very pure tones where you might not have any vibrato. And I love that. I think it's very evocative, and it's a beautiful way of playing. And then equally, you might have some Piazzolla, for example, where it's, you know, the sort of South American, let's really go for a passionate phrase where you want very full vibrato, almost like an opera singer. So to be able to go through those different styles and implement them on the different instruments is a great form of expression, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And going back to your university days, I'm curious, Like, you must have been surrounded by everyone practicing orchestral excerpts constantly, but you weren't so sure you wanted to go in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, I did. I practiced all every year for 4 years. I had an orchestral excerpt exam, so I had to learn my orchestral excerpts. And I mean, I love playing in orchestras as well. It's a, I'm hugely passionate about that as well. But so I did do that, and I was part of that. But I, at the same time, you know, there's a classic example of, for example, well, two classic examples. When I was 20, I went around America for a month on a tour bus with a rock band. When you're 20, that's really good fun. It's a great way to see America. It absolutely has no bearing on actually practicing orchestral excerpts or bettering your playing necessarily, but it's an experience. So I was up for that. And then I remember just a small note on our notice board once from a bass player in Camden looking for an instrumentalist to come and join their eclectic band that they were putting together. And I remember going to this basement in Camden with a whole load of people I didn't know. I'd never really improvised, but there was obviously something in me that thought I'd like to try that. And I'm glad I did.
That's wonderful. Well, shall we talk about your Freedom to Roam project?
Yes. So Freedom to Roam, this also came about in 2020. In fact, it came about just before that, but 2020 occurred. And whilst there were lots of downsides, of course, about that time, if I may look at some of the upsides, was that we were gifted time. From being in a very, very busy treadmill of work, suddenly having months and months of time was really phenomenal. So myself, my other half actually, Donal Rogers, Jackie Shave, who at the time was leader of Britain Symphonia, and Catherine Finch, who's an amazing harpist, we got together, we kind of worked out a style of music that we wanted to put together, and then actually separately we wrote parts of an album. We then invited other musicians to come and join us. We had other string players, we had a wonderful tabla player called Jit Bamra, and we put together an album. So that was just the first part of what then turned into a three-part kind of multimedia. We got some beautiful video artwork from a lady called Amelia Kosminski, so that each track had its own artwork that would play, that would be playing behind us as we performed. And on top of that, and I suppose this was fairly instigated by myself because it was sort of a project that I'd dreamed up over several years, we put together a little documentary. And the documentary, again, it sort of fits into a lot of the ideas of many of the things that inspire me, I suppose. It was called Connected. It was by a brilliant director, Nicholas Jones. And we harnessed stories from very ordinary people, not doing necessarily extraordinary things, but just doing really beautiful things that we should all hear about, I suppose. So, for example, a lovely lady who planted thousands of trees with loads of children in Glasgow ahead of COP20, I guess, at the time. And a man who in the 80s raised millions of pounds to rewild a big glen in Scotland. You've then got one extraordinary woman, I suppose, Virginia McKenna, who was in the Born Free film many years ago, and she set up the Born Free Foundation. She was talking about her life. She's now 91, I think, and she was talking about her life's kind of dedication to wildlife. Just beautiful stories, and interspersed within the documentary was the music from the album. So it was like this lovely triptych, I suppose, of a multimedia. And then we took it on tour, and we had wonderful standing ovations across the country. It was a beautiful project to do at that time, I think.
Were those some of your first performances after lockdowns?
Yes. I mean, frustratingly, if I may say that as well, the first performance, so the big launch, was in Cecil Sharp House, which is a brilliant venue in London. And it was on the 18th of December 2021, which was, I remember the date because it was a new, it wasn't a lockdown, but a new strain of COVID had just come about. Yeah, so nobody wanted to come out because it was a week before Christmas. So we did actually, we had a great audience, but credit to everyone who came out to us that night, because it was literally like, if you caught COVID then, you would have to miss Christmas. Yeah, it was a frustrating time still, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah. So that project hasn't really continued, or do you think you might do some things with it?
That's definitely, it's still alive, but it's a slow burner. I mean, in fact, it has continued in that last year. We collaborated with a small ballet company called Ballet Folk. Amazing, amazing company. And we played at two festivals. So we put together a whole short ballet with seven dancers, I think it was, and we put that on at two festivals. So that was a kind of continuation of the same music. And I think the next step for Freedom to Roam is that there'll be a new album on the horizon at some point, but I can't tell you exactly when.
Okay. So you mentioned Donal. So he's also on your new album and in your group, Ranagrai.
Yes. Yeah.
And are you partners?
We are. We are. So he's my life partner, as well as my bandmate and collaborator in many ways. He, funnily enough, when we started the band, when we'd been together for several years, and we just thought, oh, it'd be lovely to have a band together. He comes from much more of a sort of blues indie background, and I obviously come from a classical sort of folk, but we both had this love of folk music. And I think you can hear that in the band and the music, the style that we play. He's actually the main writer. He's the lead singer. He's been a writer all his life. He can't read music. I read music. So we've come from really different sides, but it's been a really amazing part of sort of both our musical journeys, I suppose. And I would say he's encouraged a lot of the things that I do. If I have these mad ideas and, what about this? And I could go there and I could collaborate with this person. And he probably gets a little bit exasperated with all of my ideas, but he's quite a major part of those as well.
That's wonderful. You've toured a lot with that band. Do you have any memorable tour stories?
Oh, many. we have toured so much. I mean, I'll tell you a time for anyone who's, I guess you can liken it to a string quartet, you know, to chamber ensembles, in whatever genre you're in. If you have something that you have grafted at and put lots of hours and lots of time in and made lots of sacrifices for, you know, there are lots of times I could have possibly done, let's say, some orchestral work, but I'd have a tour in with the band and I'd stuck with that. Last summer, we played at a festival in England called Cropredy, which is run and set up by Fairport Convention. And that year, I think we played to about 17,000 people. Now, I've played to 20,000 people with other artists. That's not a daunting thing to do in any way. But when it's your own band and you're stood on stage and you're playing the songs that you've been playing for 10 years and grafting, you know, playing in tiny little folk clubs, I cannot tell you how full my little heart was actually standing on that stage and going, this is our music and this is our product and our project. It's worth every bit of sacrifice and every bit of graft, I think.
In Canada, we don't use this expression, graft. What do you mean by that?
So just when, you know, when you repetitively work hard at something and you don't let go of it, I suppose kind of dog with a bone type of thing.
Okay.
You know, you see some things come and go, don't you? So you see bands that have maybe, we've been running for 12 years, it's not that long, but it is quite long. And it is a lot of, you have to put the hours in, the blood and sweat of, I'm going to do this tiny little gig here, and then I'm going to drive for 7 hours and do another tiny gig. But it's worth it for those 40 people who are at each of those gigs. And I suppose that's, the more you build those blocks, then when you stand on a stage and play to 17,000 people, you think that was worth all that effort and all that exhaustion, I suppose, of continually doing it.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of podcasting, which
yeah,
most podcasters give up after about a year. But I, you know, when I see the map of the listeners across the world, it's maybe not a lot of listeners in each place, but it's very gratifying to know that we're connecting.
Absolutely. With so many. Are you 100% are grafting? And you have to just keep it going, don't you? And you have to believe, and I'm sure there must be times when you're editing or, you know, chasing artists or whatever it is, or trying to fit things in, that actually you think, I could stop this and have some life, a lifetime away from it. But actually for those moments beyond that, it's so worth it.
Yeah, for me, very much. And came out of the pandemic, like so many musicians, we ended up branching out and doing different things.
Yeah, it's great. We're grateful. We're grateful for you.
Hi, just a really quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes I've linked directly to this one in the show notes, which I think may interest you, with Bansuri master Milind Date, Sarah Jeffrey of Team Recorder, singer Omo Bello with the project African Art Song with Rebecca Omordia, instrument maker and community music advocate Lindsay Pollock, and also the kora player and vocalist Sophie Lukacs. In the show notes on my website, leahroseman.com, you'll also find a link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get exclusive information about upcoming guests, a link for my Ko-fi page to support this project directly, where you can buy me one coffee or every month, and my podcast merchandise store. You can also review this podcast, share it with your friends, and follow on your podcast app, YouTube, and social media. All this helps spread the word. Thanks. Now, back to my conversation with Eliza.
Yeah, you know, I started improvising during the pandemic as well, and some things have come out of that that are very beautiful, but again, without the formal training. And I've listened to different, you know, the music I feature on this podcast is music I've listened to my whole life. Although I'm a classical musician, I have always listened to lots of jazz and world music and lots of experimental and different traditions. And so I'm sort of bringing that all together.
That's so great. It's great. It's good to keep your blinkers open wide, isn't it, in a way? Yeah.
It is. Yeah. Well, you mentioned your love of wild places, and I know that you've had this love of Scotland and particularly the Hebrides Islands. And I had looked at Trees for Life and the rewilding when I was researching you. It was really beautiful to see, especially coming from Canada. And I've only been to Scotland once. We were there on tour, and I remember looking out the window at these barren hillsides. And then it was explained to me about the sheep and the deforestation.
It's crazy, actually, isn't it? So, I mean, I don't know Canada. I've only been to Montreal, and I would love to come over and see some of the wilderness in Canada, actually. Like, that's high on my list. But in Scotland, funnily enough, what I've always loved is that kind of barren land. I'd always, whenever I'd gone up there, I'd always loved, you know, it feels somehow very raw, and it's there and tangible, and you can see the earth, and it's just wild. It is wild. And then suddenly when I started looking into this and realizing and researching about the trees and the rewilding, and as you say, the deforestation, the deer and the sheep, actually it suddenly hits you, gosh, this land shouldn't be treeless. And once when we actually went up to film there for the Freedom to Roam, and we went to Glen Affric that's been rewilded with Trees for Life, it's so beautiful. And it's the simplicity, for anyone listening, the simplicity of kind of what they've done is just literally putting up fences to keep deer out and sheep out, so that actually the trees can grow. And just looking along the line of a fence on either side of the sort of barren land, and then this sort of wild wilderness of trees and life, you suddenly realize how important that is, actually, and beautiful, absolutely beautiful. I mean, we live here on the side of the Malvern Hills in Worcestershire, And even this, it's not wild, it's quite maintained. And you think, gosh, imagine the spaces if they were all covered in trees, if we could do a little more rewilding or introduction of trees in some of the areas that where they've been cut down or they aren't anymore. It's an interesting concept, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So these islands, are they only accessible by boat?
They, apart from Skye, there's a bridge from the mainland over to Skye. Mm-hmm. Let me make sure I'm right with that. A couple of the other islands, their bridges, if they're very close. The Isle of Seal, I think, is very close as well. That's near Oban. Have you been to any of these islands?
I have not.
Well, I mean, I thoroughly recommend them if you ever come back to Scotland. They're very magical. Again, there's something, maybe there are other places like Norway, probably Canada as well, that have equal kind of magical elements of wilderness. But there's something so just in contact with the wild, I suppose, that I just love. The literally the wildlife there is amazing. The sunsets, even when it's raining and dark and the sea is wild, there's something so beautiful about that. I absolutely recommend it. If you like wilderness, the Hebrides are the place to go. And peace, peace. One of the islands I spent many months on actually had no electricity. So to just sort of quieten down as the sun goes down and just feel at one, I guess, with the cycle of the day is very beautiful, is very peaceful.
So you must have taken quite a hiatus to be able to do that.
So that was actually pre-music college. That was okay. That was when I was 16. So it was between A-levels and music college. Between GCSEs and A-levels, in fact, now that I'm thinking about it. So those, yeah, between the main exams before going to music college. So already at that time in my life, I think a love of, it's funny as you get in, you know, I'm in my 40s. It's funny to look back at what influences us, isn't it? And even things like writing an album now and going, okay, little 16-year-old who's listening to African music whilst lying on a island in Scotland looking at the stars, you know, that and playing my flute in Scotland, one of the lovely stories, I suppose, is that the island I was on was surrounded by other islands and caves, so you could hear the flute reverberating back. So again, those things sort of, they come to haunt you, I think, throughout your life, the blueprint of what you fall in love with when you're younger.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked a little bit about, so you started using a loop pedal during the pandemic.
I did.
I've spoken to so many musicians on this podcast who, same thing.
Yeah.
And it is quite a learning curve, right? To get good at it.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I'm a million miles away from being proficient on the loop pedal yet, I suppose. But it's just a whole other world. It's a whole other world of tech. I'm a complete technophobe. Well, I guess it's, you know, you must have had to learn loads to start a podcast up. But I'm a huge advocate of pushing boundaries and I know it's all probably sounds very cliched, but stepping outside of our comfort zones. I'm really pro that. I give workshops and classes about it. So I guess I'm just making sure I'm not a complete hypocrite, and a loop pedal and technology is amazing, awful, inspiring, and nerve-wracking all at once, I suppose. But yeah, I'm really glad I found it, but I'm really trying to work out how best I can use it. There's so much that I don't know about yet.
Yeah, I'm going to link my episode with Lindsay Pollock. He's a really amazing Australian musician who spent his life creating instruments. I think my reel of him with his rubber glove bagpipe has gotten more views than anything.
Brilliant.
But he's, you know, he started out actually, I think, making bamboo flutes as like when he was a very like a teenager, and then it evolved into this incredible career because he was one of the very, very first people to use a loop pedal way, way back.
Okay.
And apparently it was so short what they could do that it was ridiculous, like maybe 2 seconds. Like there just wasn't, because the technology wasn't quite there. But he made it work at that point and then developed it over time. So
I mean, I can't. Yeah. So I actually had a concert last night, and I finally felt like, okay, I know. I can, because, you know, you have to be so, especially because I'm using the balafon a lot. I love rhythm. I just love rhythm, which I think is really unusual in a way for a flute player. Just because so much, whatever genre it is, the flute is the melody. So to actually have to layer rhythms, you've got to be so centered with a loop pedal. You've got to be so in time with yourself. I mean, I do loads of recording to click track, so I'm very used to that kind of metronomic playing. But to actually have to set that yourself so that you kick the loop pedal at the right time, and it's an exciting challenge. I laugh at myself a bit because I think, what are you doing, Eliza Marshall? You could just say, you know, I could go and just do the gigs that I'm booked for and rock up with my flute and piccolo, and it'd be a whole lot easier. But life isn't just about ease, is it? I think it's about learning, and this is definitely, I cannot imagine having a loop pedal of 2 seconds length, because this is, somebody was asking me at the gig, so how do you know what, you know, where you're placing something on each track? And the pedal that I use, I have 3 different track options, and within those tracks you can layer them up. So you could layer however many I wanted to into track 3, and then I obviously layer up track 1 and 2, and then if I want to delete track 3 so I can start a new layer, I can also do that whilst it's all running, which just feels exciting. It's like a big large sheet of paper, and you've just got loads of paintbrushes and you can explore it.
Having seen some of your videos on YouTube of doing this, it's very theatrical in a good way, and you're sort of dancing, you know, as you you do this stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, isn't it? I wonder how many musicians you have who also say this. I think in lots of ways I'm probably quite an introvert. You know, I sort of liked the pandemic, being in my own little world of things. It's quite nice. At the same time, I love being on stage. I love expressing myself and being lost. What also happens with a loop pedal, because it's just generally just me, I have to kind of let go of any inhibitions as much as I can and just let myself get into whatever's coming out, and because I'm saying words as well and expressing a whole other side of myself that we're not used to when we've got an instrument that we can hide behind, I have to let go of any form of feeling introvert or inhibited. And so, yeah, I think I do move around quite a lot. It's quite good fun.
Yeah. You had mentioned, Eliza, that you do these workshops for people about getting out of your comfort zone. What context and how do these work?
So another string to my bow, I suppose, is that I have a West End show. So I play the flutes on the Lion King in London. That's been my job for nearly 11 years. It's wonderful. I feel really blessed to have the job. I have lovely colleagues. You know, I feel very lucky. It means that various music colleges and various colleges and like flute academies and things get me involved quite often. They want me to go through the flutes that I play on the show and what, you know, what it is to be in a West End show and what that takes. And so I'm very happily do that. And then often I get asked back to do a kind of a little bit more of what we've just described, like looking outside of the box. What do you do if you're studying at the academy, but you're not sure if you want to be an orchestral player or Guildhall, Trinity? I've also done workshops at. And so I think I just like to open the, exactly what we were just saying, so to open the minds in a way of like, you couldn't study at better institutions than these places. Of course, you know, in US and Canada, you've got amazing institutions as well, wonderful classical places. But there are so many students going through, and maybe sometimes they don't necessarily know that there are lots of other options and lots of other opportunities. I actually think compared to when I was studying, which was in the early 2000s, I think the world, the musical world, has become much more innovative. I think there are far more people looking at opportunities and looking at collaborations. And, you know, I think that it's a different world in a brilliant way. But I would like to just give people even more confidence to allow themselves to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Because opportunities arise from that, I think. And funnily enough, if I had to talk about my career, I think I'd say I feel like every element of what I've done has helped another element. So I think being in a folk band helps. You know, I worked for Joby Tolbert anyway, this composer who wrote the ballet. I'd already played classical flute on various sessions of his. But then when he knew I was in a folk band and he wanted a folk instrument at the Royal Opera House, you know, who would have known that those two threads could marry? Mm-hmm. So I think being authentic to oneself, but also not having fear of trying new things is really, I think it's a good attitude to try to take.
So I'm curious about playing the same show for so many years, how you deal with it psychologically, and also in terms of your working conditions, how free are you to book out, sub out if you need to do other things?
It's, again, that's such a good question, and it's a question that I think we get asked quite a lot, particularly on a long-running show like The Lion King. It's been running for 26 years. I think good colleagueship is absolutely the top. You have to, you know, it's a really good, we have so many, we get on so well. We have a really good dynamic in the pit, which I think is really important, and I think people have really honoured that, because they know that it's a really tight group of people to be together for so long playing the same thing. So I'd say that's pinnacle to the success of coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. It's a great show. It's a great flute part. I always go with an attitude of I need to play my best. I need to always try. I'm sure I don't always, but I want to try to. So I go with a fresh approach as much as I can. It's very easy to sub out. We have very supportive people around us as well. So long as I fulfill the amount of time I need to be there, then I guess that's probably why I have lots of creative projects outside of that, to make sure that I counterbalance what I need, creatively as well. So it's a great balance. It's really lovely. And of course, playing the same thing over and over, I'm sure, you know, nutcrackers occasionally and similar such things. Once you play it a lot and you play it every year, I mean, look, I've played the Nutcracker lots of times and I absolutely love it, but it's not a good comparison probably to playing a show, but it's the same thing. You've got to always try and bring your best, even if you feel the repetition occasionally.
Yeah. Well, track 6, On and On, does feature the choro. Ansumana Suso?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. This I just felt was a lovely, actually, again, comfort zones. You know, I sing a little bit on this track. I'm absolutely not a singer, but I do believe that the voice can be a nice texture, and this is all about textures, isn't it? So, and I love the whole kind of, somewhere I've never been to before is the Amazon. I love this idea of like the continuity of water, the flow of life everywhere. That, you know, I'm looking out right now, I'm looking out at trees and it's a bit cloudy, and where's that moisture come from and where will that travel? And maybe one day that'll pass over somewhere near where you're at, or, you know, this beautiful flow of the world. How do we look after that? How do we nurture it? How do we keep it fertile? talks, I think, on and on, is about the fertility of the world and looking out for that, I suppose, looking after it both as this planet, this, you know, look beyond in the world of Elon Musk out there, and also right close to home, like what's on our doorstep and how do we look out for it. Yeah, I love that track actually.
So how did you meet him, the kora player?
And Sumana. So actually, I've got more of a story about meeting Addy, but And Sumana, he was just recommended. I needed somebody. I wanted to have somebody else playing some percussion because Addy was coming over when we were recording. And Sumana was recommended to me. He lives in London. Okay. But so he just rocked up on recommendation, and he was just the most beautiful player and lovely, lovely human. So it was like a blessing. He actually came and played some percussion and then said he had his kora with him. And I was like, okay, I think I've got a track this could work on. So it wasn't really planned. It just happened. And again, that's quite nice, actually.
Yeah. So meeting Addy.
Yeah, meeting Addy. So actually, Addy, I met in 2019. I'd heard about, I'd mentioned the Freedom to Roam project to somebody. And I'd said, I'm really wanting to write with some amazing African percussionists. I'd really like to have some great percussion on this. And this lady said, oh, there's an amazing group of some wonderful Senegalese players who live in Italy. So I actually just took the weekend off and I popped over to Italy. They had a workshop that weekend. Addy was there. I just was blown away by him. He's this amazing player and he's got such a presence. I just thought, I have to do something with this guy. Brilliant. Lockdown came, COVID hit. It couldn't work to get him involved in the Freedom to Roam project. That wasn't possible. And then after that, once that had happened, then it sort of came about, this whole idea of doing a solo thing. Actually, a few people sort of gently, I wouldn't say pushed me into it, but they sort of coaxed me into the idea of doing my own thing. I got some funding from PRS, Women Make Music, here in England, and the Arts Council, specifically to develop my use of loop pedal, to develop my own writing, and to go to Senegal. So that funding kind of gave birth, if you like, to this, like, I now have to fulfill this album. And Addy, I contacted and said, look, I'd love to write and record. I've written, I'd love you to record onto this. And he said, come to Senegal, come and stay with my family. I went and stayed in his family flat. There were 14 of us in this little flat. It was amazing. It was an amazing experience. And I would say I feel very, very close to him. And he's an integral part now of like what I will go on to probably write and continue to do with him into the future beyond this album.
I know you've been back to Senegal, but that first trip, what did you think you learned from that?
Oh, I learned such a lot, actually. I mean, you know, these two different styles, it doesn't have to be anything to do with where we live or where we're born. In fact, just myself and Don, as in Don, my other half, are good examples. I rock up at a studio where I sight read lots of stuff. That's how I'm trained. Don writes so much stuff. He can't read a note, but he absolutely hears it. So the difference between learning to read and learning orally, I think are really massive, and I think the more that we can overlap those a little bit, the better for both sides of the musicians. So obviously, well, not obviously, but certainly whilst I was in Senegal, the musicians I was working with then, it's a huge oral tradition, the rhythms that they would come up with, or the rhythms that are part of their blood. It was just amazing to be in the midst of, one night I was in the midst of 20 percussionists, this thundering sound. I don't think anybody there was trained or knew how to read music, but what they were creating was absolutely unbelievable. And that for me was a really good lesson of, yes, I've written all this music, but actually let it flow as well, and let it take its root with what other people bring to it, which is very different from, and now you shouldn't write parallel fifths, and this is how this chord should sit, and you're not allowed a particular note at the bottom. You know, the theory that we might learn in a music college, obviously those rules don't have to sit or have to be adhered to, but it's great to expand the mind to work with musicians from such different backgrounds. So I think I learned an awful lot.
I was wondering that, like, the griot tradition is very male dominated. Being a woman in this space, did it feel comfortable? How did that work for you?
I mean, you've just read my mind, because I literally was just thinking, I wonder if that's something I should mention. So it is very male dominated, and it is, you know, I was in a studio with 16 men, very forceful, brilliant, but very strong characters. I absolutely can hold my own in that situation. That was not a problem. I enjoyed it. But I was very aware that it would be nice to see more women involved in that. We did go to a dance company. In fact, this was when I was surrounded by these 20 drummers. And that was very much both men and women dancing. And actually the women were playing the djunjuns, which are really big, low bass, bass drums. And that was really wonderful. And I commented on it at the time, just saying, you know, this is really important for me and for maybe in general to see that more women get involved. So I was aware of it. And let's hope that that becomes more inclusive and slightly more equality in those things as time goes by.
Do you know Rebecca Omordia?
The name definitely rings a bell.
She runs the African concert series at Wigmore Hall. So it's the classical music of Africa and the diaspora. She was on this podcast, and I was curious if you'd connected with her at all.
I didn't know that she'd been on the podcast. I have listened to some of your podcasts, of course, but I didn't know that she was. She works with Leon Bosch.
Yes,
who I know very well. Mm. And I know that he's involved in that as well. I haven't connected with them, and I should do. I should do, yeah.
Yeah, just curious about that.
Yeah. No, it's funny, because that side of my life has always kind of come under the umbrella of sort of the folk side. It's now actually becoming apparent that it's, you know, it's a bit more inter-genre. Let's create a little word there.
I also had Omo Bello, who's an amazing singer from Lagos, Nigeria, who did an album with Rebecca of African art songs. So focused on that, and it, like, the indigenous languages and that whole thing. It was very, very fascinating.
Wow. I'm going to go and listen to these podcasts of yours. That's brilliant. How do you find everybody that you interview?
It's interesting you ask, because if I want to get a certain kind of diversity, which I am interested in, then I have to seek it out. Otherwise, it's predominantly white men who are in the United States, usually, honestly. That's like most of the submissions. And I get people ask me every day to be on the podcast, so I'm booked very far out, and I have to say no to most people. But if I'm interested in And, you know, a lot of my listeners are in the UK and Australia and different places, and I'm interested in a worldwide perspective, but I have to remember to reach out to people. So I was following like Songlines magazine and different outlets in the UK. So I found out about people that I've had on, and I just reached out. I mean, it doesn't always work, these cold calls, but yeah, more and more I find it does work.
Yeah, that's great. It's really brilliant. It's important, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But I must say women, like through their agents, they'll reach out to me, but in general, women do not ask for interviews.
Interesting. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? You wouldn't think that is a thing actually still.
I find it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's important to voice that and pursue, you know, keep pursuing the diverse interviewees that you have. I think that's great.
So we haven't talked about the fact that you've toured with Peter Gabriel, and he's a bit of a mentor to you as well, right?
Yes, I mean, Peter Gabriel, it's funny to look at points in our lives, isn't it, that affect us, I suppose. So touring with Peter, I think that started in something like 2009, was when we first started rehearsing and recording. And honestly, growing up, I'd listened to lots of his songs, but I wasn't like an avid, I am a this fan or a that fan. I just liked bits of music. But there was one song that he wrote, Biko, about actually a sad story of a man in Africa. But it somehow resonated when I was younger. And then suddenly realising that actually that's what we were re-recording. We were recording that track, but with orchestral backing instead of his band. So that, it's again, I just love the thread of life. You know, amazing to suddenly be recording one of the tracks that you loved in your youth. I think his whole demeanor as a musician, he's he's an amazing singer, he's an amazing campaigner, I suppose, for human rights and just humanity as well. Being on stage with him, I think when I've said I've played to 20,000 people, that would have been on Peter Gabriel tours. You know, we did massive venues, but in amazing places. So places like Red Rocks Amphitheatre in the States, you know, the O2s in O2 in Berlin, or Verona Amphitheatre, massive, beautiful old stadiums. That at that time I was 29, which is quite a impressionable age, I suppose, or stage of when you're just discovering what you're doing. I'd just started working in the West End. I'd been depping on The Lion King. I'd been in other West End shows. I'd been depping in orchestras. Suddenly to do that, I think it was once I finished my touring with Peter and I was already with Don as my partner, that I think we then said, let's have a band. I want to do this. Yeah, that was accidentally, again, who knew, but that had a big effect on my life. And even now, going into my writing now, I think I'm very influenced by a lot of the stuff that he does and a lot of the writing that he's done. I love his writing. Yeah, and he's just the most lovely man as well, so.
Okay. Well, actually, track 7, Dust to Dust, it starts with percussion only, and you're playing quite a bit on this percussion as well, right?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I'm almost a bit shy to admit it, but I am. And I wrote the lyrics to this track when I was flying over the Sahara, actually, the first time I went to Senegal. And just looking out over that vast expanse of nothingness, I guess, and then seeing little pockets of dwellings and little sandstorms and, you know, just thinking, my God, this is just such a huge expanse. And yet people live there, things are going on, and there's life, and who's there, and what if I was born there? What would my life be if I had been born there? So I guess I wanted that, it's not bleak in any way, but it's kind of isolated. And I wanted to somehow put that into the music, so you literally just start with like sticks, I think, just hitting one another. and then you bring the djembe in, and then some of the electronics kick in, and then this very sort of hazy flute, just to sort of try to place somebody in just being surrounded by sand and dry and heat and not really knowing what's going on in that space on this planet.
I was curious, it's a little personal, so tell me if you don't want to talk about it, but in some of your promo materials, you do talk about the fact that you haven't had children.
Yes.
So in terms of your legacy, maybe you think about it in a more holistic way, like, but it does resonate with you to think about what you're leaving behind.
Totally, yeah. And it is very personal, but actually I know that I put that in my publicity. So I think I felt like it's a big part of the whole idea of eternal birth. So it would be incorrect of me to miss that out, even though I don't want to, you know, overly display all my personal life. But at the same time, I think it's so important to say, look, this is part of my life. And to then, it really makes you delve into again, what, you know, who am I? What do I leave to the world? Or what do I... And that, I think, is why you go right back to the Thomas Hardy idea of like, well, we leave ourselves. We leave ourselves and we become whatever it might be that we become. And again, that could be, if you want to put that into a religious connotation, that could be something spiritually, or it could be very scientific. That it's basically, it's a big part of the whole meaning behind eternal birth. And so I think it's a really lovely thing to express that, even though obviously it's not the whole focus of the album. It's just an important thing when we write, we take so many inspirations, don't we? And I think that's part of the inspiration in a lot of these words. So it's nice to let people know that.
In your bio, you mentioned playing with Stevie Wonder. I wanted to ask about that context.
Yeah, I mean, that was a lovely day. So as part of what I do, I guess I do lots of sessions in London. So we get to play with lots of different people. We play on lots of different film soundtracks and etc. And one of those days was playing, it was all the old Stevie Wonder tracks with orchestra. And he was there that day. And he is amazing as well. And again, isn't it just so interesting to see what all these icons kind of bring? So he would just... Maybe we'd play something. It was with a big orchestra. Maybe we'd play something and then you'd hear him over the kind of tannoys. You know, can you just... I'm not even going to attempt to sound like him, but he'd say, you know, can you just phrase this bit a bit like that? So instead of it like this, just a bit like that. And you just go, oh my gosh, amazing. How wonderful to hear those easy... kind of easy instructions from such a fine musician. So... Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice life moments those are.
You've been on a lot of soundtracks, a lot of famous movies. People have heard your flute. And this album of yours, it does have this kind of cinematic quality because of the layering. Have you thought about writing music for film? I mean, you know kind of what that scene's like. It's hard to break into.
I mean, I absolutely hadn't thought about it until I started doing this. And then I started realizing that is something that I love. I do actually love film music. I think it's, apart from its accessibility, I like how emotive it can be, I suppose, and how it can represent a mood in a particular way. So it's sort of accidental that it's quite so cinematic. And then I guess secretly it's also not. And that is something that I love. So yeah, I am actually interested in that. And I think it's just very new, you know. Part of me thinks I wish I'd found this in myself 20 years ago. But then 20 years ago, I wasn't who I am now.
Yeah.
So, you know, how these things happen. So yeah, I'm excited to see what it might lead to, and simply in where I might develop to as an artist and as a writer, as much as a performer and a flute player. I'm quite excited to add that to just a whole load of learning that I want to do. And I think generally I tend to learn on the job, so.
This beautiful album cover, it's such an evocative photo. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and the photo shoot?
Yeah. Thanks, you're asking such lovely questions. Can I just say I really appreciate how much you've put into researching everything for this interview. That's really lovely of you. Thank you so much. That photo that we chose for the cover, I suppose it sort of syncs in with what you were asking about the more personal side of this album and the personal connection to me and my life. I felt like, again, as a flute player, I'd look at that photo and I think, what are you doing? You're kind of... you're in this strange position, and where's your flute? So that's my identity as a flute player. I always identify with my instrument. I'm sure you can appreciate that feeling. This album is slightly beyond that. This is slightly more of a personal, in-depth musical journey with me. And I felt, in a way, somehow, just even just the positioning of, like, I mean, this is how much I thought about it. Just the positioning of, like, holding my hand close to my chest in a way, it sort of shows, it honours, I think I'm quite a deep thinker and I'm quite a deep feeler, and it honours that to myself, that this is something very special to me, and it's like I'm holding it in a way. Mm-hmm. I'm also not looking at the camera because I'm slightly shy. I don't want to give my whole self to it, but I think by holding my hand to my chest, it's just very... like, here I am. Mm-hmm. I've never described that to anybody or even to myself. So thanks for asking, because that's a very natural answer that's just come out.
Good. Well, maybe let's just end by talking about track 8, Interconnected.
Interconnected. Isn't that a lovely word? Our lives are all interconnected, aren't they? Everything we do, everyone we touch, everyone we speak to, it matters. So I think, again, it's quite an uplifted track, this one. It's not too introspective. There's nothing dark about it. It's very much, let's harness this. Let's all be interconnected and know that our lives affect one another in a beautiful way, hopefully. And obviously, just before I sound like some big, happy, fluffy bunny, I'm very aware of a lot of the traumas and terrible things that go on in the world. So I'm not in any way in denial, but I think I would like to embrace the things that can help some of the not so good things that are going on in the world. How do we help those? And maybe by being and embracing our interconnectedness, that might somehow enable a little bit of help into the areas of the world that need it.
You know, Eliza, we talked a little bit about keeping psychologically healthy with playing a long-running show and doing different creative things and taking time out. But I'm curious, do you have any other sort of self-care things you'd be willing to share about, you know, working so many late nights and how you stay healthy and grounded?
Yes. I mean, I'd say I'm not good at this because I'm a complete workaholic. So actually, I could do with some advice from lots of people if anyone has any advice. But I would say I have a dog. She's my absolute lifeline, getting outside. So if I didn't have a dog, I would say still getting outside, going for walks, fresh air, looking out beyond the screen. It's so hard So many things need to be done online, and so much is in our phones these days. And the minute you look out and you look beyond that, and you remember to have a wide vision and perspective, I think that's, I would say that's more important than ever in a world that is very technologically run these days.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my biggest, that's what I attempt as much as I can. And then just for me is being outdoors. I like to get out and swim outside and anything to do with the natural world, and I'm in.
So I want to thank you so much for this today. Really appreciated it.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for all you do with your podcast. It's really, really appreciated by lots of musicians.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Keep in mind, I've also linked directly several episodes you'll find interesting in the show notes of this one. Please do share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support the series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.